This edition of The Entrepreneurs was first broadcast on the 21st of August 2013 on Monocle 24. The Entrepreneurs, in association with Pictet. Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs, Monocle 24's weekly business show. I'm Sophie Grove. To start off this week's episode, we meet a man who started one of the most popular websites in the world.
I feel this very strong sense of responsibility that for whatever reason, I can say something and it's in the news about politics. I really enjoy sort of reminding politicians that the internet really matters and you can't just bumble around.
More from Jimmy Wales up next. Then we'll head to San Francisco to meet an unusual and delicious success story born from the recession. Yes, cream puffs.
Trent and I grew up with our younger brother and older sister eating cream puffs. That is my mom's famous recipe. And we had them for special occasions, Christmas, birthdays, all growing up. It was our favorite dessert.
We'll meet Chris Schroeder, who's traveled the Arab world and comes back with a glowing business report card.
It's not certain how it will play out, but there's certainly opportunity there that was unprecedented and untalkable even 5 years ago in the case of the Middle East.
We'll also be in Barcelona. We'll get a primer in intellectual property rights for young businesses and give Diesel a branding overhaul with our friends at Wink Creative. All that and much more coming up this week on The Entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 97 of The Entrepreneurs. I'm Sophie Grove. We start the show with a bit of an experiment now. Turn to your search engine of choice. Type in whatever you ate for breakfast, or the model of car you drive, or your mother's city of birth. Then click Go. It's a fair bet that one of the top hits is a website you've used instinctively for years. A website that has unconsciously or not become your go-to reference point on the internet for pretty much anything. If you were to gauge the success of a service on how integrated it is into your everyday life, then Wikipedia is perhaps the web's biggest winner. The man behind this, the sixth most visited website on the planet, is Jimmy Wales. And for a generation raised in large part online, what Jimmy created in 2001 is perhaps just as important to them as food or shelter. It's 30 million free articles written collaboratively by volunteer editors around the world in 287 languages, is seen as much as a public service as any real earthbound organisation with staff and a board. Jimmy visited Midori House recently to talk with our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield about the current state of Wikipedia, the relationship between government and transparency, and his journey as an entrepreneur.
The tech industry here is growing rapidly. There's a cool scene with lots of cool stuff going on. But the fact that it's not Silicon Valley, I think, is to its advantage, really. I don't think there's anybody who really thinks, gosh, if only I could live in San Jose, because it's not that great. Whereas in London, you do get this amazing intellectual cross-fertilization, the kinds of different people you can meet and work with who you would never find in Silicon Valley is pretty amazing.
And talk about the sort of work that you do now. A lot of what you're doing seems to be, in a way, quite political. It's activism in a way. It's about saying, you know, it's about opening things up rather than, you know, what's the new thing that's going to make me a huge amount of money?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I, for better or worse, I don't really care that much about money. I have a very nice life. So, and I feel this very strong sense of responsibility that for whatever reason, I can say something and it's in the news about politics. And so I can bring issues to the forefront that might not otherwise come to the forefront in at least some small way. And so that's something that I really enjoy doing. I really enjoy sort of reminding politicians that the internet really matters and you can't just bumble around. It's something I enjoy doing.
On that issue of the internet really matters, you can't just bumble around. You know, you've been doing some work here with the UK government. This government doesn't always strike me as the sort of government that really understands how the internet works. Is that fair?
Yeah, but I think that's true of all governments. And there are some really great people in the UK government and some really horrible people in the UK government relating to the internet. And, you know, this is a coalition government, but even more than that, I think it's Cameron, for better or worse, it truly is a cabinet government. It doesn't all flow top down from Cameron, but what that means is there's completely radical disconnect between different parts of the government. Some parts are very keen on technology and so forth. Others are just, I mean, would roll back the clock 15 years if they could in favor of copyright lobby and so on. So it's really, it's a mixed bag. But I think that's true basically everywhere. You know, you'll have different politicians who have different levels of understanding, or in the U.S., different levels of being paid off by relevant interests. So, yeah, it makes for an interesting environment, because just when you think, ah, oh, this is really great, I mean, the government really is doing just a fabulous job, and then you open the newspaper the next day and you see the latest boneheaded idea that they've put forward. So then what do?
Where does your activism come from? Because it's, you know, to look at your career, it doesn't, correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't on big student protests when you were younger. That I don't get the sense that there was a sort of big idealistic young teenage Jimmy Wales who wanted to change the world.
No, there always was. And it's actually one thing that's quite interesting is that I come from, and we in the world of Wikipedia, we come from the free software movement. Open source software, which has always been quite political in a small p political sense, political about issues of openness and freedom and making rational decisions and so forth. And that grows, of course, out of a deeper kind of geek culture, sort of the culture of Star Trek, you know, the sort of a rational universe with hopefully thoughtful decision making and a little bit of boldness. And that kind of culture for a long time was just within the computer industry, right? And it didn't really matter for everybody else that programmers were banging on about the importance of sharing code and so forth. But now that everybody's using the internet, issues of copyright, for example, impact all of us. In the old days, if you took a little film of your kid's birthday party, a little movie, and you sent it to grandma, you wouldn't have any, it would never occur to you to think about what's the copyright law for the music that was playing in the background. Now you make that same film and you make it for grandma and you put a little soundtrack on it. You go, this is so cute, we'll send it to grandma. And YouTube detects the soundtrack and silences your movie. And you think, well, I'm not a pirate. I'm just somebody trying to make a kid's birthday party movie. You know, it's a bit bonkers. And there's a million ways that this kind of thing impacts people. All the kinds of things that people are trying to do online. Suddenly, what we've been talking about for a long time about openness and taking cognizance of the impact of these technologies on our lives, which are not only just the simple things of like, oh, well, now I can look up a restaurant on my phone, but all the different things about who I can communicate with. These days, of course, who's tracking me? Who's watching me? How do we deal with those kinds of issues? So suddenly, issues that used to be political only within the computer science world are now impacting everybody.
And do you find that online activism, if I can call it that, then filters through to the way you see the world on other issues, whether that's, you know, whether that's same-sex marriage or whether that's, you know, the war in Syria? Do your thoughts on openness and freedoms extend to those as well?
I think I have a coherent outlook on the world, and it's a very common sort of modern techno-utopian kind of worldview, which tends to be, you know, quite small L libertarian in nature. For certain issues, I think it's probably a little harder for me to see what is the nexus between mobile devices and gay marriage. A little hard to say exactly. But when you think about something like Syria, absolutely, because you're beginning to see people who've lived in very difficult, oppressive situations for a long time finally begin to be able to get organized, finally have a means to express their outrage and make change happen. And it's not easy, of course, because, you know, it's all lovely to imagine, yes, we're all going to get on Twitter and agree to meet in the square and we're going to overthrow the dictator. And that's worked a few times. And then other times he comes and shoots you all. And then you've got a really big problem. So I don't think we can be naive about these kinds of things. But there's no question that technology is impacting the world in some really fundamental ways.
Do you think that the way that we use technology is going to, at some stage, settle down? We'll work out, because it's not just governments that are trying to work out how to use technology. It's all of us. You know, how much do we share on Facebook? What do you know? How much do we say on Twitter? Which other things do we sign up to? Do you think that within a decade or two decades there'll be a moment where actually we all kind of get it now? We've worked out the limits of what we're willing to put out there, and we've maybe set up some rules to limit what else other people can put out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we do have emerging understanding, emerging social norms. You know, we can be as simple about that as sort of the classic idea of, well, gee, college students, you might want to think twice about which drunken pictures you put on Facebook. They may come back to haunt you. That's a very simple way of thinking about it. I think much more complex and much more difficult, you know, would be questions about how much do we trust Facebook? How much do we trust Google? How much should we be thinking about using encryption to protect ourselves from being snooped on by the government or by, you know, mafia people who are trying to steal our credit card numbers and steal our identity in various ways? Those are still very much in flux and very much nobody really quite knows how certain things are going to go. And I think it's really interesting.
And to go back to Wikipedia, where does this website go next? Because it's, in a sense, it's, you know, it's all working very well. You've got tens of thousands of editors and moderators and all sorts of other people chipping in on every conceivable subject of every second of the day, and you occasionally having to step in and try to in some way suggest which direction it should go in. Does it just keep on happening like this with the occasional fundraising drive?
Yeah, I mean, I think the essentials aren't going to radically change. We're not about to become YouTube, for example, or do anything crazy like that. I would say the two areas I would watch for change. One, we have now in beta our visual editor, and that, you know, it's another one of these cases where at first you think, all right, they're changing the editing interface. I mean, could I stab myself in the face and be more bored by such a useless technical piece of information? But it's actually quite important, because one of the things we know about the Wikipedia community is that we tend to be very largely tech geek in nature, and that implies and that brings along with it largely male. We've got a lot of computer geeks in the community, and traditionally it's been, when you click edit, it can be a bit of a learning curve. You have to learn a wiki markup language, and loads of people are geeks but not tech geeks. And so in order to diversify the community, we have this new editing interface, which is in beta now and really under fast improvement and development. And we think that's going to help us to diversify the community.
Does that mean that someone like me who, frankly, I'll be honest, if I was to click on an edit page, I wouldn't even know what half the words mean?
Yeah, you'd know what the words mean, but you wouldn't know what all the little squiggly bits mean.
Yes, exactly.
And you could learn it. I'm confident of that. But why would you bother? Like, you've got a life to live and so forth. So we want to diversify the editing community. And this, we think, will help to bring in people of different age range, people of different backgrounds, you know, more humanities-oriented geeks, more women, and so forth.
What does your current editing community think of that? When you say we want to diversify you?
They're very supportive of that concept. Again, who we are is, you know, a bunch of tech geeks, and we do come with a certain open mentality. The other large category, so there's the visual editor and the attempt to diversify, and that would be, you know, thinking about all the major languages that we already are very big in. But the other form of diversity is the growth of Wikipedia in the languages of the developing world, and that's a really key part of our plans going forward. We're in over 200 languages, but a lot of the languages in the developing world are very small. They don't have nearly the quantity and quality of content that we would have. And there's a lot of things that we're trying to do, pilot projects and experiments to see what can help with that. A big part of it actually turns out to be technical. A couple of years ago, I met with a bunch of editors in India who were explaining how they would go to this Google transliteration thing and type there and then cut and paste into Wikipedia because our keyboard entry methods, we didn't support all the ones that they wanted. That's improved to some extent now, but that's the kind of investment we have to make. And the other element, of course, is mobile. You know, the next billion people who come online are largely going to come online for the first time using a smartphone. And so we want to make sure that not only is their reading experience very good, but to the extent possible, which is always going to be tricky on a small device, that they can participate in editing as well. So there's a lot of challenges in that area.
That was the founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, speaking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Now, as youngsters, brothers Reese and Trent Colvolth were in love with their mother's home-cooked cream puffs. So when they decided to start a business, they didn't have to think too hard about what they would like to sell. Monocle's San Francisco correspondent Alistair G reports on how they've built a successful company despite opening Pacific Puffs when the economy took a nosedive.
At Pacific Puffs, a shop selling cream puffs on Union Street in San Francisco's Tony Marina district, customers are savouring the handmade treats.
Mmm, the best.
Despite being founded in 2009, at the height of the recession, Pacific Puffs has prospered and is a demonstration of how, with the right product, and in particular with the right recipe, you can make a go of it, whatever the economic climate.
The story is basically a family recipe. Trent and I grew up with our younger brother and older sister eating cream puffs. That is my mom's famous recipe. We had them from the time we were one year old. And we had them for special occasions, Christmas, birthdays, all growing up. It was our favorite dessert.
That's Reese Carvold, one of the two-brother team behind Pacific Puffs. Trent, at 31, is 3 years his senior, and also only has fond memories of their mother's dessert.
As we were growing up, she really perfected it because we asked her to make cream puffs so often.
When it comes to puffs, what most of the customers at Union Street comment on is not the dough or the topping, but what's inside. Reese says that this is for good reason.
What you fill your puff pastry with is what counts, and a lot of people will do just custard, or, you know, to make a profiterole, do kind of an ice cream filling, or a lot of people just do a straight up whipped cream. And what our mom's recipe does is it combines custard and cream in kind of a special way to create a really kind of unique pastry cream that's really good.
At the store, customers come and go, often ordering a dozen puffs at a time.
I just want a dozen.
Dozen? Mini size?
No.
Regular size?
Yeah.
Okay. And just an assortment of them? Or
half chocolate, half vanilla.
Watching it all from a table at the front, Reese recalls how the company got started. He and his brother were both sick of being stuck in corporate America.
We were both in cubicles working with spreadsheets. I was working at Dow Jones doing venture capital research, and Trent was at eSurance doing marketing. So very typical 9-to-5 kind of rat race jobs that weren't bad, but we just weren't thrilled about and wanted to, you know, get out of the office, basically.
They had no background in cooking or running their own business. But what they had was that recipe. At first, Trent says, it was a slog.
For about the first 6 to 8 months of the business, Reese still had his day job working at Dow Jones. He had to be at work by about 8:30 in the morning. So we had to have all our production finished by about 7:30. So he had time to get home, take a shower, and then get to work. He would go off to work. I would come and work the store all day here on Union Street. So our mornings usually started about 4 a.m. So that was a pretty rough startup phase.
Now they've honed the process to the point where they can make several thousand puffs a day, and one of them is still in the kitchen every morning. Much of their success stems from branching out into the food truck scene early on, enabling them to cater to family and corporate events.
All right, so Laura just took down this order. It's Victoria just called in. This is August 24th, food truck event. We would be the only dessert truck there. It's for 600 people in Livermore.
Perfect.
Seeing as they have a foot in both camps, they say that they're unusually attuned to the resentments that crop up between the owners of brick-and-mortar restaurants and food trucks.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, obviously we're huge fans of free market, but it can only be so free. You know, we wouldn't want someone with a competing cream puff truck to pull up in front of our shop right here on Union Street. On the other hand, if they were to pop open 300 yards away, which is what the city stipulates for, I believe, the buffer zone for a truck with a similar concept to your food, then it's just competition. And I would say, you know, we believe in our product. We think it's better than theirs. And people are going to shop at Pacific Puffs and not the truck down the street.
Pacific Puffs currently has 2 shops, 2 trucks, and about 20 people on payroll. One person particularly pleased with their success is their mum, Noreen, who remembers her reaction when Trent first came to her with the idea.
Trent called one day and said, are you and Papa going to be around? I want to come up and talk to you about something. When we sat and listened, Trent's father said, don't quit your day job. And within a month, Trent had quit his day job. So at first, you know, it was at a time that economically things were kind of at a down spiral, and we were somewhat worried, but I have to say that from day one, Pacific Puffs was welcomed, and I don't know whether they told you, but that first day they opened at 11 o'clock, and I think they were sold out by 1:30.
Back on Union Street, the lesson from the success of Pacific Puffs seems to be that if there's something that you love, you can be fairly confident you'll find other people who love it too. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alastair G.
After the break, we'll speak to the author of a new book on the burgeoning entrepreneurial spirit in the Arab world.
Entrepreneurs make new money. We protect it until it becomes old money. Pictet, experts in wealth management since 1805.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the time shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. Most daily headlines from the Middle East are grim. Violent crackdowns, car bombs and sectarian strife are all the order of the day. Of course, there's much truth to this, yet sometimes the bigger picture is missed. Just ask Christopher Schroeder. He's an American venture capitalist and internet executive who's just released a book that counters much of this pessimism. In Startup Rising, the Entrepreneurial Revolution Remaking the Middle East, Schroeder recounts his travels to Cairo, Beirut, Amman, Istanbul, Damascus and Dubai, where he meets with young entrepreneurs who refuse to fail, and where the giant companies of the day, from Intel to PayPal and Google, are making big inroads. Christopher spoke with Monocle's producer, Alad John.
I've always been interested in the central issues of our time and where the world is going. I'm an internet tech entrepreneur and investor, and I'm always kind of looking ahead as much as I'm looking to the day-to-day, because I know that we can get very stuck in our own narratives, the one thing we think today will be in the future. But about 3 years ago, I traveled to the Middle East to go to one of the largest gatherings of tech startups that's ever been held in the region. And when I got there and I saw this amazing level of innovation and creativity and very good business building, in many respects, I look at my whole worldview as before that event and after it.
So that was a fairly seismic moment for you. Why is there such a potential for tech specifically as a growth area in MENA?
You know, it's ironic that it was such an aha moment for me, because I, like a lot of internet CEOs, have outsourced technology around every corner of the world, Israel certainly. And so in some respects, it shouldn't be surprising, because to your question, this is happening everywhere and has been happening everywhere for a while. Mark Andreessen, in the foreword of my book, said that within 8 to 10 years, 5 billion people will have smartphones. And so in a lot of respects, the real answer to your question is it shouldn't be surprising at all, because it's happening everywhere and it's still in the relatively early days globally.
We'll come on to Mark Andreessen's foreword of your book in just a moment. But before we do, I'm interested to know why you think, as you mentioned there, you yourself had a kind of before and after moment with that conference. Why has the West or Western investors been so reluctant to look to MENA for potential opportunities?
I think that there is a phenomenon in human beings generally, not just a Western phenomenon, of being captured by a narrative. We tend to reduce things and look at the world very simply. But having said that, I think within the context of the West, there's something very unique in our mind that at the end of the day, an entire region like Africa is viewed as a place that has been corrupt and have corruption and wrestled all kinds of issues of poverty and AIDS and so on. Whereas we all know now many things are happening in many different parts of Africa. It's not just a monolith, which are unbelievably encouraging. And the same goes for the Middle East, right? In the West, we have a narrative that says this is about a war and it's about sectarian violence and it's about chaos. It can't happen there. And it just goes against all of our instincts of things that we thought 20 years ago couldn't happen in places is now happening everywhere. So the bottom line is we should all know better, but we're caught in our narratives.
So do you believe that there is perhaps a balance between the sort of perceived volatility of the region and a good time to invest?
I think that the balance is incredibly real, right? I mean, to dismiss the uncertainty that is in the region right now to dismiss the terrible violence in places like Syria is, of course, foolhardy because these are very, very real. But I guess I'd say two things. One is it's very risky to look at any region as a monolith. To say what's happening in Damascus is what's happening in Dubai would be a terrible mistake. So I think at one level, you really just have to step back and look at things and say that we live in a world where two narratives may coexist. And in fact, they may coexist for a long time. But the second point is we have seen in the last 10 years of economic development in places like Brazil, in places like India, Lord knows places like China, that we all would have been very skeptical of. Two parallels can continue to exist, and it's not certain how it will play out, but there's certainly opportunity there that was unprecedented and untalkable even 5 years ago in the case of the Middle East.
In your mind, how important is entrepreneurship for the Middle East?
I think it's absolutely not only critical, but it's there anyway, right? So it's not like a thing that you can sort of put your hand on and will it. We're talking about the human instinct and desire to create things that were not there before and solve problems for themselves and their families and their communities. And in so many respects, this incredible courage and willingness to kind of walk through walls to simply will things to happen is fundamental in terms of, I think, opportunity for people to create societies for themselves. In the case now of these emerging worlds where you have, and the Middle East is a perfect example of this, you know, where you have a huge bulge of young people coming, I've not seen a study yet that says, from an economic perspective, that traditional means of government largesse or traditional means of businesses are going to be able to absorb all the people who are coming to fruition. And so that means that there's an incredible opportunity when people have these tools in their hands to connect with each other in ways they could never connect before, find at their fingertips almost all of the world's knowledge so they can bring it to bear and create economic opportunity for themselves.
So looking at the travels that inspired your book, you took on board quite a range of countries, Dubai, Cairo, Amman, Beirut, Istanbul, yeah. Some of the more westernized cities as well, and Damascus. I'm presuming that was pre-conflict. I'm fascinated to know which one of these places or which entrepreneurs from these countries stood out to you.
The question that I get most often is, what is the Silicon Valley of X, right? If you're in India, what's the Silicon Valley of India? If you're in the Middle East, what's the Silicon Valley? I think there's only one Silicon Valley. I think it's an extraordinary place with an incredible network effect of talent. What Silicon Valley has unleashed in the software development and the access for everyone to get software that really works in their person, I think are pockets of innovation that we're going to see all over the world. We're going to see amazing software developed, I believe, from parts of the world that we would never think of it before. And that's certainly the case in multiple places in the Middle East. Having said that, there's absolutely no question that Dubai, as a strong economic place with one of the best airports and transaction kind of communities in the Middle East and with incredible traditional companies like Aramex, means that e-commerce is going to flourish in places like that. The King of Jordan made incredibly direct decisions some years ago to really invest and support the ICT community and now the startup entrepreneurship. So you see amazing young people coming with great engineering prowess there.
How are each of those nations' governments kind of reflecting this sort of growing trend of entrepreneurship?
I think that they're sitting on one of the most central opportunities in their country's histories to be able to make concrete decisions to embrace this. And what you see is sometimes a lip service, sometimes some movement and change in regulation and rule of law, which I think can be encouraging, that moves slowly. But at the same time, you know, the internet makes a lot of powers nervous. This is not just a Middle East thing. It certainly is happening in Asia and elsewhere. And so there'll be internet laws that come forward, which, you know, sometimes can be stultifying. And the internet flourishes in transparency and connectivity and openness, and unbelievable things happen when you have that. And a lot of countries right now are making decisions about whether or not they're going to try to control this or allow it to flourish. And I think a very, very interesting question they're going to have to face is that if you start to fall behind technologically, you know, how do you really keep up over time in a global economy? This is a very talented young generation, and the best will find the best place to go to create and succeed. And nobody wants to lose the best talent, because in the end, most of these people really would love to stay at home.
That was Christopher Schroeder speaking with Monocle's Alad John. Now on to Spain. As August draws to a close, the Mediterranean city of Barcelona is marking an end to the busiest tourist month of the year. Thousands have descended upon the city for some well-deserved holiday fun, and many of them from the region's elite. Many are drawn by the city's rich plethora of culture, leisure and luxury. But once they touch down, who is there to lay out the welcome mat? And how exactly do they manage to disconnect when their relentless business interests continue to vie for their attention? Answering the call, a new generation of private service-based companies have emerged, and luxury concierge and lifestyle management firm Alberta Le Group is one of them, providing close-knit, trustworthy and often seemingly impossible service to a range of clients. Lourdes Cabo and her diligent team work around the clock to ensure her clients get exactly what they want. Monocle's man in Spain, Liam Aldist, travelled to Barcelona, where he met the firm's perpetually busy co-director for lunch, where they discussed how the changing face of luxury tourism has been a boon for her business.
If there is one thing Lourdes Carbó's clients understand, it's the value of time. Together with co-founder Marcos Hirsch, the pair opened their Barcelona-based concierge and lifestyle management firm, Alberta Le Group, in 2006. Lifestyle management is an admittedly ambiguous description, but Carbó succinctly describes it as a service providing value-added time for a select range of high-profile clients.
This is what we do every day, helping people to be concentrated in what is really important for them, but then we are in charge of the other things that could be done.
As a business, I imagine this would be hard to sell to a potential client. How do you do that? How do you convince them that time is the most precious resource and that you can give them that time?
Well, in fact, the best client is that person who knows that they need time for other things and that they want to delegate. Not all the businesswoman or the businessmen are ready for delegating. Delegating your private, your personal life or tasks on your life, it's not easy, it's much difficult. It's not a question, convincing is the everyday, no? Making things right and trying to generate the addiction, because you are really effective, you can solve problems, you can save money.
While a luxury concierge service might usually be tasked with facilitating state-of-the-art hardware, such as a last-minute yacht to sail across the Mediterranean, or securing VIP access, like hooking up front-row concert tickets, over time, Lourdes has witnessed the demands from her clients evolve. It's a change which she argues has much to do with how the definition of the term luxury has also continued to evolve.
The word luxury, as everything is changing, the market is changing, and it's not easy to sell the luxury of time. It's not as easy to sell a bag or something like that. It depends on cultures, it depends on where you live, where are you from. The luxury for you, for example, in Shanghai, luxury could be space. And it's not the same in Australia. It's totally different. It's very personal, as you know. So we like to talk about lifestyle. The consumer of luxury products are thinking more in intangibles than in tangibles, because you can accumulate pairs of shoes and bags and clothing, and that's good. But at the same time, more people think that it's more important to collect moments and not things. And people are paying a lot of money for traveling, but not because of traveling, for discovering a city. The question is not where are you going, the question is what have you done there. So people are paying a lot of money for experiences in that place.
Alberta Le Group's team of diligent professionals pull their resources and networks together to turn the seemingly impossible into livable experiences, and often the very next day. Like any good problem solver, in this business you are only as good as your ledger, and it always pays to have a little bit of foresight too. So how exactly does she recruit members of her team?
You need to be on a natural way. You have to be comfortable with working for someone. Sometimes they have extraordinary lives and you do the hard work. You are here because you are the problem solving. There is more than 137 different skills and capabilities that we have determined according to our Alberta Le Group style. The most important three for us are discretion, maybe curiosity, and trying to find out what's new in the city, multitasking or time management. That's the three most important pillars. If you are a concierge, you can think on a concierge of a five-star hotel. You go there and you ask the concierge for a reservation for a restaurant, and probably he or she will make you three questions in order to find out what are you looking for. So it's a reaction. I don't need to know a lot about you. But if you are a PA and your client wants that you know everything about them, their likes, dislikes, their preferences, everything. So you can be proactive, and you have to think and organize something before you think that you need that. For example, you have a client that her daughter is going to study the next year in Switzerland. So you are going ahead and trying to prepare, because if something happens, you need someone, other contact, to build your network to solve any problem that could happen or not.
To maintain their promise of impeccable service, Lauderdas has had to carefully manage her firm's expansion. It's a delicate balance. But apart from the main office in Barcelona, currently her 100 or so clients are supported by an increasingly mobile team. They operate from a network of offices in London, New York, Miami, and Dubai. And in response to Barcelona's changing tourist demographic, there are plans to establish a permanent presence in Astana and Moscow too.
It's easier to try to make things big and try to get your name or the name of your company and try to have more employees and generate more helping on the economy, of course, and providing a good service. In fact, that was a natural answer of what our clients demand, because they have a concierge service sometimes. But what's our difference? Our difference is a personalization. Again, private client culture. We have the keys, we switch off the alarms, we open the doors, we go to the desk, we check this information that they need. And that's something that you can do only if you know the people, if they trust on you, and if you give this kind of level of service.
For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Liam Aldous.
Original ideas are the essence of many businesses. Whether it's an invention, a witty trademark, or a whimsical design for the catwalk. One thing any budding entrepreneur must contemplate when they're setting up shop are the ins and outs of the law. And so here at The Entrepreneurs, we took it upon ourselves to draft in an expert on the transactional technicalities of the intellectual property world to get some key advice for patenting, copywriting, and safeguarding concepts. Kenneth Mullen is a specialist in IP, brands, and technology at the 100-year-old London firm Withers. The company represents large fashion labels and small creative businesses alike, and Mullen dropped in to give some pearls of wisdom. We started by asking him to define IP.
Intellectual property, or IP as it's known, is a general phrase used to cover a range of different legal rights that you can have. Effectively, they protect creations of the mind. There are patents, which effectively protect new or novel inventions. Physical machines or pharmaceuticals or innovative processes, but basically it's to protect new inventions. The second is copyright, and copyright really protects artistic creations, written works, music. It's more to do with artisan creations, but it also can, interestingly, protect computer software. The third type of IP is trademarks, which protects the brand, the names, logos, colours which are associated with a particular business or a particular product. And a fourth, which I should mention, are design rights, which basically protect the way, as the name suggests, a product looks. In some cases, it can also protect the actual patterns that a product has on it. And it's used a lot, say, for example, in the fashion world as a way of protecting the intellectual property there.
We hear a lot about people trying to trademark things like yoga positions and things that are already out there. But when do you know that you have something? When do you think, as a lawyer, there's an urgent need to copyright or safeguard your concept or idea?
I think you've got to think about the key rights that, you know, your business is going to have. What are the key things that are going to generate income for your business, that you're building your business around? Is it a unique idea that you have? Is it a unique invention you have? It could be software, it could be an algorithm, it could be an actual brand name or an identity that you want to sort of build up around a particular business, or it may be a combination of any of those. So you need to think about the sort of elements that are key to your business. I mean, I would say that it's always best to try and get advice as early as possible about the things that are important to your business and the things that you can get protection for. Not everything can be protectable. Sometimes high-level ideas aren't necessarily going to get protection automatically, although you can try and protect them in other ways through confidentiality agreements. But it's important to think about the types of intellectual property that are going to be important as your business grows, and try and, you know, think about this as an investment, because if you build up some intellectual property in your business, it's something that's going to be of use later on if an external investor comes in, for example, or if ultimately you're looking to exit from your business in the future, a potential buyer will be looking to see what protection you've got with intellectual assets in your business.
Let's talk about confidentiality, because that's something you just mentioned. How hush-hush should you be in the early stages of thinking of a business? So many people are so excited, desperate to get their idea out there, going to dinner parties and holding court on what a fantastic concept they've come up with. Should they be doing that?
Well, you need to be careful, I think, is the answer there. Particularly if you are thinking about an idea which relates to an invention, you can get protection called patent protection for new inventions, which can be a very strong protection if you're able to get it registered. But one of the prerequisites for that is that it shouldn't be publicly known. And of course, as soon as you start telling people, the risk is that, you know, that type of information is going to leak out into the public domain. So I think if you have an invention, you need to be very careful about who you tell. Very often what you need to do is make sure that any discussions you have with external parties, potential investor, be it a potential business partner, and even an advisor, you need to make sure that the conversations are protected by a confidentiality agreement or a non-disclosure agreement, as it's sometimes also known. Or if you're dealing with an advisor, that it's covered by professional privilege, because unless it's confidential, the risk is that those ideas are going to leak out and you won't be able to get the protection that perhaps you could probably get if they'd been kept secret.
This idea that some entrepreneurs get too hung up on the idea of IP, and that becomes, in a way, their nemesis and distracts them from what they should be doing, which is building their business.
Yeah, this is a bit of a non-legal answer, but, you know, very often some entrepreneurs, and quite understandably as well, will get fixated on their idea or their business concept. And that can get in the way of actually getting the important stuff done, which is going ahead and executing it into a proper living, breathing business. That can be to the detriment, ultimately, of the business as well, if people become too fixated. The other situation, of course, is that sometimes, because of that fixation, they might not see the wood from the trees. And by getting out and speaking to people, they maybe could have realised that, you know, the idea perhaps wasn't as original as they first thought, or that, you know, the idea needs to be refined a bit. So, I mean, what I would always say is, you know, legal protection is very important, but any entrepreneur's got to be prepared sometimes, you know, as painful as it might seem, to maybe ditch the idea that they have or try and refine it in a way. You know, don't necessarily get too hung up. Go out and speak to as many people as you can. Get the professional advice you need, but also speak to people in the industry as well, because they can give you guidance, particularly people who invest in businesses. You know, they very often can be quite quick at turning around and telling you whether they think your idea is as unique as you think it is.
And maybe take it as a huge compliment that you've been emulated very occasionally.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the other thing to bear in mind, of course, is that sometimes the best protection you can get, certainly against people copying you, is to have a successful business. Get out there, make it successful, and then, you know, it will sometimes also make it easier to actually claim your legal rights against anyone who tries to infringe your intellectual property.
That was Kenneth Mullen with me on all the intellectual property rights you need to know. We'll be back with our weekly branding chat right after this short break.
Despite its decline in value against other economies since 2001, the US dollar continues to influence global trade. As Yves Bonzon, Pictet's chief investment officer, explains.
In a dollar depreciation regime, typically, all assets that benefit from cheap dollar financing tend to perform well. So in the last 10 years, since 2001, we had strong performance from emerging market equities, emerging market debt, gold and commodities.
To hear other expert views on emerging markets, trends and foreign investment, visit perspectives.pictet.com.
Welcome back to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Sophie Grove. Time now for our weekly branding chat, where our colleagues at Wink Creative mull over a branding problem and a solution. This week, we chatted about the brand Diesel with Joel Todd and Corinna Drossel.
It's a brand that's been around for a long time, founded in 1978 by Renzo Rosso, Italian brand, as I'm sure most people will know. But as you say, it was sort of late 90s, early 2000s, when they really started to reach their peak. And they, you know, we remember they were the cool jeans brand to have. You know, everyone had a pair. They were expensive. And even though we were young at the time, you know, when you got a pair of Diesel jeans, you felt like, yeah, okay, this is it. But in recent years, we thought, when was the last time you even went into a Diesel shop? You know, they've really, really lost their way. But when we looked into their history, it's like they were a very pioneering brand in many ways, not just in terms of the product. You know, arguably they introduced the concept of a premium jean into the market, but also, you know, their marketing communications, which, you know, were very award-winning, very attention-grabbing. So they've got, you know, this real sort of history, this real brand equity that they've definitely lost in recent years.
And Corinna, a very interesting figure in the form of Renzo Rosso, who actually has irons in the fire elsewhere in fashion. He's very directional. I mean, we saw some very interesting advertising campaigns, as you say, but he also, I mean, he owns a lot of other brands. Can you give us an insight into how this has really defined Diesel and why he might want to update and rebrand it rather?
Diesel has always been at the kind of has always been known for kind of controversial advertising, especially in the kind of mid-90s. Their advertising was really at the peak, and I think everybody was incredibly well received. And it was in the same vein as the kind of Oliviero Toscani Benetton ads were. They were controversial, they were bold, and they were challenging. So Diesel, for example, they would work with incredible photographers like Terry Richardson, Ellen von Unworth, and Ranking. They featured actually the first gay couple in a fashion ad, two guys kissing. And this wasn't about the clothes that the guys were wearing. It really was about a political message that they wanted to bring across. So apart from that, I think that was another interesting fact that we found out was Diesel was the first fashion label to have a website in 1995, as well as an online shop 2 years later.
Yeah. That's pioneer.
I know, who knew?
It's something that sounds so unbelievably par for the course now, but how interesting that is something that was pioneering in those days. Tell me a little bit about why you think it went wrong, Joel.
I think in, you know, many ways, Diesel has become a victim of its own success. You know, it's expanded all over the world, but they've also expanded their product range to such an extent that, you know, now they've got fragrance, underwear, swimwear, glasses. They've even got a hotel, their own headphones. You know, another quote from Renzo Rosso, he said, you know, it represents a lifestyle. When you love the Diesel lifestyle, you can apply it to every aspect of your life. And that sort of like monolithic branding approach, I think they've basically lost sight of what their core offer is, which were the jeans. It was the denim. That's why you went there. So I think that's one part of, you know, why things have gone awry for them. But at the same time, the market's changed. Obviously, we've got a lot more successful high street brands now, particularly in the UK. You know, they're able to produce more on-trend products at a cheaper price. And then you've got challenge coming in from edgier, you know, more minimalist newcomers like Acne, Nudie from Sweden, and J Brand.
Corinna, Renzo also has another company, Only the Brave, which actually owns Marni. I mean, he really understands the market, and he's recently appointed a new creative director, which kind of points to the fact that he knows that something is amiss in the company. Give us an insight into who this person is and what you think they might do. Why was it so successful in the first place?
Well, indeed, Renzo Rosso has acknowledged that Diesel needs a revamp. And I think just as so many other fashion brands do now, where they really appoint an individual, the creative director, to be the face of the brand, we've seen this. I mean, I think Tom Ford was the first one who did that for Gucci. And then recently, obviously, you know, Phoebe Philo for Celine, Hedi Slimane to the max, I think, with Yves Saint Laurent, who really made the brand his brand. So I think this is exactly what Renzo Rosso has in mind for Diesel by appointing Nicola Formicetti. He's formerly the stylist of Lady Gaga. He's very well connected to the celebrity world, so he can bring a lot of that to the brand. And really, they're asking him to kind of create a total view of the brand from product to marketing, communications and interior design. And they're calling it already Diesel's second life, if you visit the website, which then connects to his blog. So they're really kind of letting us wait for a drastic, dramatic change of the brand.
A second coming is an interesting concept. Definitely sort of admitting that change needs to be taken. But what do you think we'll see, and what do you think, Joel, should be done with the brand?
Well, I think, you know, we both think, you know, it is a good move that they've appointed a creative director. But I think one of the things that they need to focus on, again, it comes back to the product. You know, there's a lot of noise around the communications. They're saying, you know, you want Nicola to, you know, reinvigorate that sense of what the advertising had in the 90s. But now, really, it's not really enough just to have a strong advertising campaign. The shopping experience has to be simple. It has to be accessible for people. And their shopping experience, the website, ironically, given that they were the pioneers on that front, the website is very cluttered, difficult to navigate, and as is the, you know, in-shop experience, which they actually deliberately apparently make it confusing so that you ask shop assistants for help. But again, I think, you know, times have changed. People don't have the time for this anymore. They're not interested in something just being, you know, trendy or quirky. They want to get to the product a lot quicker.
It's quite interesting, a sort of moment where they have to seize that demographic of really the teenagers that love the brand so much, and then bring that on into more of a 21st century aesthetic, which possibly is less branded. Do you think that that might be the salvation of Diesel?
It's definitely good for a brand with the heritage that Diesel has, and certainly with the impact they had in the 90s, to look what they're good at and what they want to take into the new century or into their new second life. So I think that is really great. So I think, you know, they could definitely keep their kind of bold advertising. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm. But at the same time, I think with that, they need to then turn down the noise and really be much more straightforward in other parts of their communication. Certainly, I think the web, which is these days the kind of almost first touching point, especially for youngsters, with a brand to shop, they need to make it easier. And then I think they need to create other channels for any of their kind of more entertaining communications, such as the blogs, informing us that they have done a collaboration with a bicycle brand. They're designing headphones, they're designing a home interior range. Currently, all of this sits under one hub on their website, a website next to their jeans, which I find incredibly confusing and slightly annoying to interact with.
And that was Joel Todd and Karina Drossel from Wink Creative rounding off this episode of The Entrepreneurs. This show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. Our studio manager is Holly Fisher, and I'm Sophie Grove. Please feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or feedback. You can reach me at sgr@monocle.com or our producer Daniel at dg@monocle.com. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more inspiring news and views from entrepreneurs around the world.